So welcome everyone to this briefing about the latest paper out from scientists involved with the Global Carbon Report. The paper has been published in Nature Geoscience. It lifts out from under embargo this morning, or has already lifted out from under embargo. And it talks about two main messages, which obviously our scientists will go into quite a bit more. One is the link between carbon dioxide emissions and GDP. And the other thing that they will be discussing will be looking at the amount of carbon dioxide that the atmosphere is able to absorb and how that might potentially be changing. Obviously, they'll be going into a lot more detail about it. Just to introduce our speakers, Dr. Mike Harvey will be introducing the subject today. He has 26 years of experience working mostly in New Zealand in atmospheric physics and chemistry, and he currently leads the research program at the National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research, which we all know is NIWA, and looking into drivers and mitigation of global change. The program measures and models human influence on the atmosphere from global down to regional scales. His interests include surface atmosphere exchange of trace gases and aerosols. Then the next person up will be Professor Martin Manning, talking about the first part of the first section of slides. He is the director of the New Zealand Climate Change Research Institute at VUW. The institute was established to build up better links between science and policy in the area of climate change. Previously, he worked in the USA as director of a working group for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which produces the detailed assessments of climate change science for all governments, and in New Zealand also, where he led research on greenhouse gases and other aspects of climate change, first at DSIR and then at NIWA. And last year, he became an officer of the New Zealand Order of Merit in the Queen's Birthday Honours List for his services to climate change science. Finishing up will be Dr. Sarah Mikuloff-Fletcher. Sarah is also at NIWA, and she models the carbon cycle. She's used previously atmospheric observations and models to estimate methane emissions to the atmosphere, and she's also used similar techniques to determine air sea fluxes of carbon dioxide using ocean interior data and ocean general circulation models. And currently, with her studies into the carbon cycle, she uses atmospheric and oceanic models. So a very interesting lineup of people to be talking to us today. I'm at this point going to hand over to them and let them take it from here.
Okay, thank you, Amy. Mike Harvey speaking. NIWA has quite an active program of research into composition in the atmosphere and impacts of anthropogenic change and our understanding of the carbon cycle and carbon impacts on the atmosphere. So for this briefing today, I wanted to bring in two really world-known experts in carbon cycle research, and the format will be to go through some prepared slides from the Global Carbon Project. So this briefing is really being coordinated worldwide and being done under the auspices of the Global Carbon Project, which is centered out of Canberra, Australia, but has widespread international involvement. And so we will run through this prepared presentation of slides from GCP, and then the second half of the briefing will be open to questions and answers around those around that material that you've seen this morning. So we'll divide the presentation into two areas that we're going to start off with. Martin Manning covering the area, and then Sarah Mikuloff-Fletcher will take the second part. I must say we've just lost our video link and so cannot see the material at this end.
Yeah, I have
the cell phone
number for that.
Can people still hear me?
Yes, we can see you.
Okay. So we've lost our video live link, basically. I guess we can, to an extent, we could carry on with just numbered slides, if that's going to work with people, and we'll just say we're on this slide. But unfortunately, we can't see
Great.
The slides at the moment. We've just called our technician in to...
Fantastic. What we can do, Mike, is that because it's actually quite a lucky thing then that we've got the full presentation loaded, because it means then I do have an accurate idea of which of the slides you were wanting to talk about. So if you just tell me which slide number you'd like to be talking about, okay. I can change it on this side.
Fine. Thank you, Amy. So we'll kick off then with the presentation material, and I'll hand over to Professor Martin Manning.
Thanks very much, Mike, and just to fill in the background a bit more, these two guys work for NIWA, and I used to, so that tells you it's a world-class organization, doesn't it? The first slide I wanted to talk about was number four.
There you go.
That's headed up fossil fuel emissions and cement production. And it shows that the growth rate in carbon dioxide emissions has sort of picked up this decade quite significantly. If you go further back in time, actually, you see that we had higher growth rates at the end of the 1970s than we did through the 80s and 90s. And that's picked up again, and it's probably even higher now than it was in the 1970s. So there was an optimistic view that, oh, maybe we're starting to reduce the rate at which we were increasing greenhouse gases, and now suddenly that's reversed. And more will come up next. If we go to the next slide, should be number five.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then you see a split between the developed countries and developing countries. And it's clear that the reason for this growth in this decade has been from the developing nations. Whether this is due to the fact that the developed ones are signatories to the Kyoto Protocol or not is a moot point. Personally, I think a lot of us would feel it probably wasn't, because those countries haven't cut down as much as they had hoped to. However, you can see that the increase is definitely coming from the developing countries. We move on. We were going to... The next slide shows some more details of the countries, China, the United States, and China overtaking the United States. But we'll come back to this sort of thing a bit later on. If we go to number seven, you'll see a breakdown for even more countries, and you can see, again, some of them are increasing and some of them are not. And keep going, because I want to talk more about some other things further down. Then there's a slide number eight, which is balance of emissions. Skip over that, so that's a complicated issue. And nine is pretty much, I am going to talk about some of these slides in more detail. Slide nine is pretty much what we just looked at actually already, so I'm going to go past that. And then we'll get to slide 10, which actually lists the countries, and you start to sort of see some quantitative comparison, and you see that the top three countries are responsible for 50% of the global emissions of carbon dioxide, and top 10 for two-thirds. And some people have suggested that this is critical for thinking about how we will control the future climate, because maybe you don't have to get all 190-odd countries to agree on something. If you get the top 10, you'll probably drive it anyway. So there's an interesting sort of perspective coming out of this type of analysis. Slide 11 shows a breakdown between different sources of the carbon dioxide coming out. This is the global totals now, adding up from all those countries. But it's showing that oil has been more or less flat for several years now. And it's coal, really, that is the major cause for this increase. And that links back to China, because the rapid development in China has largely been driven by production of energy from coal. Then moving on, number 12 just repeats some of these same points, and number 13 does as well. A more significant issue, I think, is coming up in number 14, if we go to that. And what's shown here is, in black, you're seeing the actual emissions, their best estimate of them from fossil fuels, so that's coal, oil, gas. And the coloured lines are showing the scenarios for the future. Now, I do have to say that, and it's a point I've taken up with the authors of this paper last year, that this is not quite the right way of showing the scenarios for the future. It shows a long-term trend, but what goes into the climate model is a little bit different from what they're showing there, and the details of those scenarios cover a wider range than those sort of exponential curves that they're showing on that graph. So we are actually running climate models internationally that are already considering more emissions than are shown in the black. So we're not sort of totally out of the loop yet in the science, but it is showing that what's happening is at the high end of the range, and that's valid. We're about to switch over to Sarah in a minute, but to go to the next slide, it shows GDP growth, and we weren't really going to talk about that. And then number 16 shows the same thing that we've just been talking about again, and it shows an initial estimate for what will happen in 2009, and you can see there the drop in fossil fuel emissions due to the downturn in global economy. Whether that number is right or not, I think there's still some debate over, but I think a lot of people do expect it to drop down. And then we move on to slide 17, we'll see the split between land use change and fossil fuel, but we're going to come back to that in a minute, keep going. And the next one shows it shows the two categories of emissions of carbon dioxide, and then this one shows the breakdown of what's called land use change or deforestation, and you can see it comes very large in some countries. That's fairly well understood. Let's go on to the next one. You'll see that's broken down into larger groupings, and you can see that it's not just a matter of, it's a bit tricky, it's not just a matter of the area that gets deforested. Carbon fluxes don't exactly follow that, but they're a bit related to it. We go on to the next one, which is slide 20. You're seeing fire emissions, and then if we go to 21, and fire emissions have dropped off a bit, but 21 is sort of showing that in the context of the fossil fuel emissions as well. So hopefully the land use change might be starting to turn down now, and we have many countries saying they're going to reduce deforestation, Brazil in particular, and so fossil fuel is increasingly the big issue behind this. At that point, I'm going to hand over to Sarah.
Great. Thank you so much, Martin. So I'm going to start with slide number, are the numbers on here?
No, sorry.
Okay.
Oh, they're on some of them.
On some of them. Slide 22. Okay, fantastic. So Martin's done a great job talking about the emissions, the anthropogenic emissions, both from fossil fuel use and land use change. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about, we'll focus on what's happening to the carbon after we emit it to the atmosphere. So one of the best known components of the carbon budget is the amount that's being stored in the atmosphere. And that's known very well from a global network of observations that span the globe. The first one was started in the late 1950s, and since then the network has just expanded. And these are very, very precise and accurate measurements, so these numbers are quite well known. And so the plot in the upper left corner of this slide shows the atmospheric CO2 concentration, the global mean atmospheric CO2 mixing ratio, in parts per million, as a function of time over the last 5 years. The red line shows the monthly mean values, and essentially what you can see right away from the red line is that there's a very strong seasonal cycle, and that's due mostly to the natural sinks, which are the terrestrial biosphere, plants on land, and the oceans, but mostly the seasonal cycle is dominated by land plants. So what you're really looking at with this plot is you're looking at the Earth's biosphere breathing in and out. So in the summertime, you have strong uptake as a result of the stronger photosynthetic processes in the summertime. And then in the wintertime, as the photosynthesis weakens, you're seeing a stronger respiration signal, so the CO2 is being released into the atmosphere. Since the bulk of the land masses are in the northern hemisphere, the seasonal cycle for the global mean follows the northern hemisphere seasonal cycle. So then, in addition to that, the black line is showing the deseasonalized trend in atmospheric CO2. And so, unsurprisingly, since we've just seen the strong increase of fossil fuel emissions, you see a strong increase in the atmospheric CO2 growth. The box on the lower left-hand side shows the decadally averaged atmospheric growth rate of CO2. So over the 1970s, you had a growth rate of 1.3 parts per million per year. Over the 1980s and 90s, it was kind of 1.6, 1.5, and it seems to have kicked up in the last decade with a mean growth rate of 1.9 parts per million per year. Next slide, please. All right, so let's put together what we've learned about the fossil fuel emissions and what we know about the atmospheric growth rate. So this slide shows the growth rate in the atmosphere and the fossil versus the fossil fuel emissions in petagrams of carbon per year, where a petagram of carbon is essentially a billion metric tons of carbon. And so the first thing that you can see from this plot, the black line shows the total CO2 emissions from both land use change and fossil fuels, with the gray band showing an estimate of the uncertainty. And the blue line shows the amount that's remaining in the atmosphere each year. And you can see right away that the amount remaining in the atmosphere is actually a little bit less than half of the total CO2 emissions over the last 60 years or so. It's actually only 45% of the CO2 that's been emitted from fossil fuels and land use change has remained in the atmosphere. And so that's showing that the natural sinks are quite strong and critical to reducing CO2 in the atmosphere. And then in addition, you can see there's quite strong natural variability in the amount stored in the atmosphere. So this is showing us the strong variability in the atmosphere compared to the variability in the CO2 emissions. It's showing us that these natural sinks are associated with strong interannual variability, which is most likely driven by essentially factors related to climate. This variability is closely linked to ENSO, for example. So we're going to go to the slide number 25 now. So the two main sinks are the terrestrial biosphere and the oceans. So what we're seeing here is model simulations from land and ocean models covering the last 60 years or so. And the green line actually represents the median value of a suite of several land models. And then the green band that you're seeing around that is showing you some estimate of the uncertainty, which is based on how different these models are, essentially. And the blue line is showing results from a suite of different ocean models. So you can see that most of this variability is being driven actually by variability in the land sink, in fact. And there have been some arguments that there's a trend in the land sink, but I think this is quite strongly under debate, a subjective debate at this point. But you can see that there's very strong variability in the terrestrial sink value. Oh, I should also mention that the sign of this thing is negative values. More negative values mean more uptake by the land and oceans. So the stronger the negative value, then the more uptake you get. In the case of the oceans, you can see that there's also a trend towards there's definitely a trend towards increasing ocean CO2 uptake in the models. This you more or less expect. It's really an equilibrium process where you have water that hasn't seen the atmospheric perturbation coming to the surface and then equilibrating with the atmosphere. So as you increase atmospheric CO2, to first order, you expect the oceans to follow that, the ocean uptake to be proportional to that atmospheric uptake. So you are seeing that sort of a trend, but there's some mounting evidence from a variety of different sources that the ocean uptake may be slowing relative to what we expect from atmospheric CO2 perturbation. So I'm going to suggest skipping the next two slides and wrapping up with the kind of suite of slides from number 28 to 33 that will kind of take you through the long view of what's been going on with the natural, with the emissions and the natural things. So the first slide shows over the period of 1850 to the present, the deforestation component of the budget. So you can see that in the beginning, earlier part of the record in the kind of 1850s to 1900s, most of the deforestation signal was in the extra tropics, essentially mostly North America and Europe, But as time has passed, that deforestation has essentially shifted to the tropics, such that at this point, the majority of the carbon emissions from deforestation is occurring in the tropics. And that's about one, over the last, in the far right, you can see that the numbers that are going to be shown there are going to reflect the average over 2000 to 2008 for each individual source or sink process. So over the last decade, it was 1.4 petagrams of carbon per year. Next, please. All right, this is a cumulative plot. So on top of this deforestation, we have the fossil fuel emissions, which over the last decade or so have been about 7.7 petagrams of carbon per year. And so the top line is essentially showing the sum of the deforestation and the fossil fuel emissions. And then you can see a black line at the bottom of this plot, which is indicating that somehow all of these, all of the carbon that's being emitted has to end up somewhere. And in the next series of slides, we're going to start building up where it's going. Next slide, please. All right, so this is the yellow shaded area is the amount that's staying in the atmosphere. It actually is a little bit, appears to be kind of artificially smoothed in the period of the record prior to 1950. What's going on here is that the period of the record prior to 1950 is being filled in by ice core measurements, and these ice core data don't have very high temporal resolution. So as a result, it appears to be quite smooth. But in fact, it probably has somewhat similar variability to what's being observed in the period after 1950. Next slide, please. So 4.1 petagrams of carbon per year over the last decade have been taken up have wound up in the atmosphere. 2.3 have wound up in the oceans. So this blue shaded region shows the evolution of the ocean sink. And as you can see, it's been increasing in kind of roughly in proportion to the atmospheric CO2 perturbation over the last 50 years. And this ocean value is essentially an average of four ocean general circulation models that have been forced that include ocean biogeochemistry. Next slide. And then we have the results from five different land models, which I showed you in the kind of slide previous to the suite of slides. So you can see that they're filling in quite a lot of that variability that's observed. Last slide. And then while we would always like to have our models be perfect, there is, of course, some error. And so when you add all of these things up, there's not really a perfect balance of all of these different components. So over the last 8 years or so, the residual, essentially the difference between all of the sources and all of the sinks from these different models and other types of estimates has been 0.3 petagrams of carbon per year. So then we're going to flip to the conclusion slide. So there are two key conclusions from this release. One is that over the last 60 years, the natural sinks have taken up over half of the CO2 that we've emitted to the atmosphere. But for a variety of reasons, it's not clear that in the future, these sinks are going to be able to continue to take up the same portion. Part of that is because we're rapidly increasing the amount of fossil fuels that we're emitting to the atmosphere. And so, therefore, the sinks may not be able to continue in the same proportion to the emissions. And there is some evidence that suggesting that changes in climate may also slow the uptake of CO2 by the natural sinks, although there's still quite a bit of uncertainty about that. The human perturbation of the carbon cycle has continued to grow quite strongly and tracked really the most carbon-intensive scenarios from the IPCC estimates. So the economic crisis could lead to some decrease in the atmospheric CO2, but it's probably not going to be very large compared to, for example, the interannual variability in the natural sinks. Thank you very much.
Concluding the prepared slides, Amy, if you want to coordinate discussions at this point.
I just thought that the concluding statement on the last slide, which says the efficiency of natural sinks has been declining for 60 years, that's not what the ocean graph shows, is it? The implication there was that it had been slightly improving.
So It's kind of a relative statement. So when you talk about the fraction, essentially, the authors of the study use a metric called the airborne fraction, which is essentially the amount that stays in the atmosphere divided by the total fossil fuel emissions. So to first order, you expect that the ocean uptake is going to track with the atmospheric CO2 uptake, so then the airborne fraction would remain constant. But there have been some studies that even though the ocean uptake is increasing, actually it's not increasing in the same quite as quickly as we would expect from the atmospheric CO2, and that is believed to be due to changes in the winds over the southern ocean, essentially, due to changes in climate.
I had a question, if I may. It's Sam Hayes here from TV3.
Fantastic.
In the release that you guys put out yesterday, saying, talking about carbon sinks not being as efficient as they may once have been, the second part says, in addition, carbon dioxide emissions are still rising to reach an all-time high of 1.3 tonnes of carbon per capita per year. Is that globally or is that specifically New Zealand?
No, that's the global number.
That's global.
New Zealand emits a lot more.
Do we?
Per capita.
It's around 18 tonnes per...
No, it's equivalent.
Okay, so it's methane.
I don't have a number in my head for New Zealand, but we're more than the global average. Most developed countries are more than the global average. So the number you're seeing there is for the world as a whole. And
yeah.
Showing that the world as a whole emission of carbon dioxide is increasing.
Okay, so we're a lot higher. Aren't we sort of in the top six or something?
Depends how you do that to some extent. New Zealand's emissions are definitely higher than would be necessary.
I sort of do in the sense that I don't really quite understand if maybe we could go back to that slide that I was badgering you about before on ocean uptake and terrestrial. Just can't make the two square in my own mind. As when we went through that slide, the notes that I took anyway said that there was debate about what the land sinks were showing, whether they were becoming less or more efficient because they were showing such variability. It just seems like a very strong last conclusion to make when that's not how it looks when you go through the presentation.
So your question is essentially about the conclusion that the sinks are slowing, and you point out that the land sink, that the variability in the land sink is very large, such that you expect it to be actually quite stronger than any trend. And I think this question about this issue about the land sinks slowing is very much still quite uncertain and quite under discussion. So I'm not actually an author of this study. I'm just providing background and perspective on this, but I think that's an extremely good point and one that is likely to be addressed in follow-on papers to this paper.
And the issue is not so much whether the land sinks are static or still increasing, but whether they're keeping pace with what's going on in the atmosphere. Are they scaling up as the carbon dioxide concentration goes up? And that's where this concept of airborne fraction comes in. And so what they're saying is that we don't think these sinks are increasing enough to keep the airborne fraction constant. Now, we have to say that that's a valid point to make here, but there are other papers coming out this year which say, no, we think the airborne fraction is constant. But that's because there's a huge amount of variability in this information. I mean, you can see a lot of variations from year to year. So it's not a strong conclusion at this stage, but the fact that it might be happening is something to get worried about.
Yes. Thanks for that. I understand what you're saying.
It's Eloise here from the Herald.
Hi, Eloise.
Hello. Hey, I just wanted to ask, it showed there in the slides a slight dip, probably due to the economic downturn in 2009, but you mentioned that those figures weren't particularly certain. I just wondered if you could elaborate on that at all, whether it will take more time to estimate those figures as more numbers come in, or how certain are we about that?
Well, fossil fuel emissions come, first of all, from some of the petroleum industries, actually, and they usually come out about 3 months after the end of the year, maybe 4 months. Then this is followed up by a more detailed study by the U.S. Department of Environment, who works with quite a team internationally to try and add in a little bit more information to what comes directly from the coal, oil, and gas companies directly. And that's usually about a year later, maybe sometimes a year and a half later. And it's usually a little bit higher, but it's almost a consistent pattern that we've seen as well. So in the last IPCC report, we did actually blend those two sources of information, the private sector information as well as then subsequent scientific analysis. And because they are fairly consistent, even though there are slight differences between them. So, we'll see it come out. And, you know, it'll be interesting, won't it, to see what happened in 2009.
So it wouldn't be fair to kind of call that trend proven yet. It's still numbers to come in that will have a big influence on what the final number is.
Well, that's the point that's being made in this presentation by these international authors, is that even if the emissions do drop 1 year by a few percent, you won't really see that in the atmosphere, because the atmosphere's response is sort of an average over quite a long period of time, and it's just slowly responding. So this little kick down, again, you can go back into the 1970s and early 80s and find things that are similar. When we had big shifts in oil prices, for example, total fuel emissions across the planet actually dropped. And, you know, you didn't see carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere drop.
Because of its long life, you mean?
Well, because it's averaged over longer periods of the emission.
Right.
So it doesn't just follow 1 year exactly.
Well, I think then we'll wrap it up. I'd like to say a big thank you to Mike and Sarah and Martin for their time and for taking us through this report so beautifully. And, of course, thank you to all the journalists as well for attending.